It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk about a recent project from the Huffington Post that works as a digital tracker for incidents of violence, harassment, or intimidation targeting Muslims in America.
Before we get to that, a bill that had bipartisan support from a majority of state senators wasn't taken up on Tuesday in the Senate's final meeting of the legislative session.
The bill would have made it easier for parents to buy CBD oil or cannabidiol, an oil that's a derivative of marijuana, which helped treat seizures in some kids with a rare form of epilepsy in clinical trials. CBD oil was legalized in 2014, but patients' families can only get it from a doctor with a special FDA waiver.
The legislation would have allowed parents to get CBD oil without a prescription, but the bill was blocked in the Senate despite support from patient families and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. Here to tell us more about what happened is Jessie O'Poyne. She's a reporter for the Capital Times and covers state politics and government. Jessie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, CBD oil has been legal in Wisconsin since 2014, but can you tell us a little bit more of the reason behind this recent push to make it a little bit easier to get?
Sure. So the problem that has sort of stuck around, even though the use of the oil was legalized, is it is still illegal at the federal level, and that makes it pretty difficult to obtain. So this was designed as a fix to allow parents to access it a little more easily, to allow them to get it without a prescription. The problem still is, in order to obtain it, they would have to order it online or import it from another state, or you could grow marijuana in Wisconsin, which is not legal. So there's still kind of some difficulty there in terms of obtaining it, even with this fix.
Even with the fix of the bill, you're saying?
Yeah. But this was designed to hopefully, you know, make it a little easier for parents to not have to go through a licensed provider in order to get it.
Well, what kind of support did this bill have going into the Senate this week?
Yeah, and this bill had, you know, obviously the parents who have been advocating it have been pretty forceful in doing so. But the bill had pretty widespread support, really, senators on both sides of the aisle, and pretty overwhelming majority in the Senate. It was just kind of a handful of I believe only Republican senators who were concerned about it.
And let's get to what happened on Tuesday night, because it seemed as though it might have been, if not a sure thing, it seemed as though it had pretty good prospects going in, but it didn't actually come to a vote. So what happened?
Yeah, it had, in theory, great prospects. It cleared the assembly on a voice vote, which meant there was so much support they didn't even need to count the votes. So this was something that I think people expected to go through without much controversy or discussion. But in the end, it wasn't put on the calendar because of the concerns of that small group of senators who were fairly polarized from the rest of the group. So this set in motion sort of a confusing set of procedural maneuvers. What ended up happening was a Democrat at the end of the night tried to pull the bill, since it wasn't on the calendar, tried to pull the bill to be taken up on the floor before the Senate was about to adjourn. The Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald was anticipating this, and in order to block that, scheduled the bill for what's been sort of referred to as a ghost hearing. Basically, if a bill has a hearing pending, it can't be pulled to the floor. So he scheduled it for a hearing, which was canceled the next day, just to keep it from being pulled out. Democrats tried to fight back on that by voting to suspend the rules, but Senator Fitzgerald was able to adjourn pretty quickly and shut that down, so his caucus didn't have to take the vote.
So had that ghost hearing been scheduled before the Senate was in session that evening?
No, it came through probably about an hour before they adjourned, I think, was when the notices showed up for us, and Senator Fitzgerald got up and kind of explained to the Senate why he had scheduled it, and then explained that, yes, it was a tactical move. But, yeah, it came through after the session had started.
And what was the response from the supporters when that happened?
They were very upset. I think Senator Wengard said, this is why people hate government, this is why people don't trust their politicians, because this is the kind of thing that they don't really understand from the outside. Parents who had supported this called it dirty politics. They're disappointed that something they expected to be a fairly sure thing got held up in such a confusing and political sort of procedure.
We're talking with Jessie O'Poin right now for the Capital Times, and she's joining us to talk about some political maneuvering happened in the state Senate this week that stopped a bill to make CBD oil available without a prescription. CBD oil comes from marijuana, and it is an anti-seizure medication for rare forms of epilepsy. So, Jessie, what happens next with this? This is something that has not been resolved. Supporters will still be hoping to pass this in some way down the road. What are the prospects for that?
It sounds like this is definitely something that's going to come up again, probably fairly quickly when the legislators come back in January. I'm sure we'll be hearing from parents and supporters in the meantime, trying to push to make it happen. I think the hope of, I know some of the concerns from people who were opposed to this is that it is still illegal at the federal level. So the hope from some legislators is that maybe we'll get some more federal guidelines on this between now and then, and they'll have a little more of a pass from them in terms of how to handle this.
What kind of federal guidelines are we talking about here?
Well, it would be something to legalize the use of this. I don't know that that would be full legalization of marijuana. That's probably a long ways away, but maybe something to allow the use of this specific oil.
And in terms of what the public might think of this, obviously this is important to the politicians, the senators and assembly people who were promoting this bill were looking for it to pass, and the parents. But was there a public outcry about this kind of political maneuvering, or is this sort of par for the course?
I think people were confused is probably the best word. In terms of the actual bill, there were people who supported it very strongly. There were people who objected to it fairly strongly. And then there were a lot of people who didn't even know it was maybe an issue or were fairly indifferent to what happened with this. But any time something gets blocked based on procedural maneuvers and something that, the ghost hearings, things that don't necessarily look that great from the outside, people get upset. And we've had outcry on both sides of the aisle on that, with some attempted explanation from Senator Fitzgerald, who himself said, look, I know this probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense to someone from the outside looking in.
In terms of the concern that it could be a slippery slope, this kind of legislation that could one day lead to maybe legalization of marijuana in Wisconsin, is legalization of marijuana in the state an active topic right now, one that may not be on anyone's legislative to-do list, but is it something that people are talking about?
Yeah, it is a little bit. I mean, every session we get some sort of proposal related to medical marijuana or full legalization, and those usually don't get a whole lot of discussion because people know they're not necessarily going to go anywhere right now. But what we are looking at is some of the Native American tribes are looking at trying to grow marijuana on their reservations, and whether it be for medical purposes or recreational. And the concern, I think, from those legislators who had been watching that is they thought that the legal reasoning could be similar to what allowed for gambling on those reservations, so the legalization of the lottery. They're concerned that legalizing or expanding access to CBD oil could somehow assist in their legal argument to allow them to grow marijuana.
Jessie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Jessie O'Poin, reporter for the Capital Times, and she was with us there talking about some political maneuvering that happened this week in the state Senate that stopped a bill to make CBD oil available without a prescription in Wisconsin.
Recent reports from the L.A. County Police Department say that hate crimes against Muslims, Arab Americans, and people appearing to be Muslims spiked in the last 2 months of last year following the terrorist attacks in San Bernardino.
Advocacy groups have also reported that cases of Islamophobia rose after the terrorist attacks in Paris last November, which ISIS claimed responsibility for. In response to cases of hate crimes, harassment, and rhetoric against Muslims, the Huffington Post launched a digital tracker that records and reports cases of Islamophobia.
Here to tell us more are the people behind the project. Rowaida Abdulaziz is with us. She's the world social media editor at the Huffington Post. Rowaida, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Christopher Matthias. He's national reporter for the Huffington Post. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Rowaida, let's start with you. Can you tell us why you decided to start tracking incidents of Islamophobia?
Absolutely. Just to give a little context, our tracker actually dates back to about November, December of last year, when we started a very simplistic list of tracking anti-Muslim rhetoric after the Paris attacks, which occurred in early November. And simply put, the list was actually way too long to keep track of for just a normal article that we were working on. And we started to realize a common theme here, that these incidents were no longer isolated incidents, especially after the Paris attacks, where we've realized the amount of anti-Muslim incidents tripled ever since Paris. And so when 2016 came in, we knew we had to do something about it and launched this fairly comprehensive and digital tracker that you guys see here today.
And Christopher, can you tell us what constitutes an act of Islamophobia, something that reaches the point where you'll include it in this tracking system?
Sure. You know, this tracker will never necessarily be an entirely comprehensive list. I think there are probably, you know, a lot of daily indignities American Muslims face. You know, there are probably certain Facebook posts that your family or friends might post that, you know, we're not necessarily going to include. But basically, we are tracking, you know, moments of Islamophobic rhetoric from politicians in the media, Islamophobic policy, anti-refugee policy that specifically targets Muslims, and of course, actual hate crimes and acts of aggression targeting Muslims solely based on the fact that they are or appear to be Muslim.
And Rueda, how are you tracking these? How are you trying to find as many of these kind of incidents as you can find?
We have a number of ways that we are collecting these stories. First and foremost, we, of course, working for the news, we are monitoring news, both national media and local resources, and just seeing the incidents that may not make it up to mainstream media. And so we're being very vigilant and hyper aware of those resources. But in addition to, we've also set up an email distro on our tracker, which is Islamophobia@HuffingtonPost.com, where we've been collecting tips and stories and just communicating with everyday American Muslims who have been reaching out to us and telling us that they faced a particular incident or a loved one or a friend or a family member, in which we would conduct it like any regular story, where we conduct interviews, talk to that person, verify their stories, and after kind of launching somewhat of an investigation, we would editorially collectively decide if this was specifically targeted as an anti-Muslim crime, and we would further include in our tracker.
Okay. Also, I just want to add, mm-hmm. we have worked a lot with different advocacy groups, including, like among others, the Council on American Islamic Relations, who does a really good job at tracking these things. And the idea behind the email address, Islamophobia@HuffingtonPost.com, is to, you know, kind of have there be a central place and create a social network with these advocacy groups and across social media platforms to make sure that, you know, these reports aren't falling through the cracks and that we can kind of see them as part of a bigger picture.
In a bit, we'll get into some of the particular instances that you've recorded there. But Christopher, in addition to people using this email to report incidents of anti-Muslim harassment, Islamophobia in general, there's been an angry response, some fairly hateful email coming in. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. Kind of ironic. We didn't necessarily think about it when we started the email address, but of the hundreds of emails we've received, probably say a good 70% are Islamophobic. And, you know, basically, you know, use some pretty vile and vulgar language towards me and Rueda and our colleagues here at the Huffington Post, and really kind of effectively prove our point. But also what we've kind of realized with all this hate mail is that, in a way, this hate mail is kind of one of our best resources, because what we've kind of seen is that a lot of these emails and a lot of the misinformation surrounding Islam and American Muslims follows almost kind of a particular script that these people are getting from certain websites and certain hate groups. So in that way, it's been pretty instructive. And I think we'll, as this project develops over the course of the year, we'll use that hate mail as kind of a resource for myth-busting and looking at a lot of the misperceptions and misinformation about American Muslims and Islam in general.
Rueda, can you talk about that a little more? What kind of myths and misconceptions do you see that might be underlying some of the incidents you're tracking and some of the angry emails you're getting?
Well, I think first and foremost, one of the main things that we've noticed in the hate mails is a lot of these things are very similar, and you can see that the sources that these people are using are from the same sites and the same people who are instituting this fear-mongering type of paranoia. And so there's a lot of confusion as to what Islam is, what are the actual pillars that Muslims believe in. And to be quite frank, we're not all very angry people who are trying to take over the world, which may come to as a surprise for a few. And so, unfortunately, people are very confused as to what the religion is, just basically what do Muslims believe in and why, and how do they differ from the mainstream fear and, unfortunately, extremist groups that tend to hijack the name of Islam and Muslims and claim it for it to be their own. So what makes your Muslim neighbor different from the acts of ISIS abroad? And a lot, actually, and many people don't realize this. And so, therefore, we're seeing a lot of intertwining of politics and paranoia and blanket all of a generalization under the name of Islam and in the name of American Muslims who have been here for decades, actually, and have contributed a lot to American society. But some people just cannot seem to make that difference.
And I'll add to that, like, one thing, a couple of themes we get in our emails is this idea of creeping Sharia law coming into our courts and our schools and what have you, you know, which has been thoroughly debunked. And then there's this idea of civilizational jihad, which is this paranoid conspiracy theory that, you know, that there's some kind of central conspiracy in Islam to make America into some kind of caliphate. It's the kind of thing that's propagated by certain groups, including a guy like Frank Gaffney, who today was named a foreign policy advisor to Ted Cruz.
Talking to Christopher Mathias and Roida Abdulaziz. They're both with the Huffington Post, and they're part of a digital online tracking project trying to collect incidents of Islamophobia, violence, harassment, intimidation, targeting Muslims in the United States. Roida, you mentioned the sort of daily indignities of life. What are some of the things that you've seen, you've reported on, that have happened to just everyday Muslims as they go about their day?
Well, the disparities are quite extreme. We've documented things from just most recently a couple of young girls just trying to take a train to one of their college classes in New Jersey and being verbally harassed and yelled at and even spit on by a man, and them not being able to find help and having people watch them. Unfortunately, no one's standing up for them, conductors on the train, et cetera, to as far as people who are walking down the street and simply speaking Arabic and being stabbed because of it, and unfortunately having a member of the law enforcement being one of those perpetrators. And so these daily indignities can really do vary from just online harassment and people saying terrible things and can fatally lead to a stabbing and even some death. We've documented also a report of an elderly man who hired someone to do some yard work from him and ended up being beaten by a shovel. And so the incidents are very scary and they're very real, and which is one of the main messages as to why we are doing this. Many times people hear and we hear that Islamophobia isn't real and there is no such thing as discrimination against Muslims. And by having this, it shows that it very is real and has very difficult consequences that we have to face as a country.
And Christopher, you also mentioned, you've referred to this, you're trying to track political rhetoric and I think legislative action too.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the thing about this list is that it's, you know, really happening against the backdrop of some pretty vile anti-Muslim rhetoric. You know, the most famous recently, of course, being Donald Trump, you know, saying that he would ban all Muslims coming to the United States. Just last week, he said that he thinks Islam hates us, whatever that means. And there's been, and it's not isolated to Trump. If you look at politicians across the country, in state, local, and federal, you'll see these kind of themes emerging there as well. In New Hampshire, there are bills across the United States that are basically spreading misinformation. There's a lot of bills regarding the Islamic indoctrination in schools. There are many bills. There's one in Florida that authorizes the governor to use military, and this is direct quotes from the bill, that authorizes the governor to use, quote, military force against, quote, invaders from, quote, the Eastern Hemisphere. It's very specific, and it basically buys into a lot of paranoia about Muslims and Muslim refugees. And yeah, we're definitely keeping track of that.
And very briefly, Rueda, do you think that the climate is getting more difficult, worse for Muslims in America?
It is getting difficult, and to be honest, some say that it's been the most difficult in a very long time. However, there is hope, and we like to believe that the majority of Americans rise above this type of hate and any type of hate against anyone. And so this is out there, and we're out there, and we just ask people to speak up, and if they see an injustice, to say something, and if they hear of a story, to talk to us, because we know collectively it's only going to get better if we realize that this is a very real problem. And so as long as we continue to stay in denial, it's only going to get worse.
Rueda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Chris, thanks to you as well. We've been talking to Rueda Abdulaziz and Christopher Mathias, telling us about the Huffington Post's new efforts to track anti-Muslim violence and harassment.
Coming up, our guest says it's time to consider renegade rules for parenting, like telling kids it's okay to go up the slide. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Some rules you give your kids seem to stand the test of time, like don't play with sticks, you'll poke your eye out, and do your homework. It's how you'll get ahead in school and in life. But our next guest says a lot of these old rules maybe need a rewrite if we want to raise confident, creative kids. She says risk-taking is actually good for kids, that kids should learn to use those sharp objects, that homework should be banned for elementary school children, and that it's okay to let kids skip the hugs from the relatives.
Heather Shoemaker joins us now. She's a parenting expert and the author of It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. Heather, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what are renegade rules when it comes to parenting?
Well, I think you summed it up. It's turning upside down some of the rules that we just take for granted and we never question, like safety first, don't talk to strangers, do your homework. Because if you look at these a little more carefully, sometimes the opposite is actually better for the kids.
And a lot of parenting seems to take up where our own parents left off, and we end up sometimes repeating some of the things that we heard growing up just because that's what you say in a certain situation to your children. And one of those old adages is safety first, and it seems to make sense. You have children, you want them to be safe, otherwise no one here is better safe than sorry. What do you say to that one?
Yeah, well, I have a chapter in the book called Safety Second, and it's really to help us as adults, you know, as parents and teachers, get our minds around the idea that, you know, safety is not the all-important rule that we need to follow when raising these kids, because kids are learning and changing and growing, and to grow the best, they need to take healthy risks. There's a little there's pervading fear going on, so that a lot of parents are actually preventing their kids from taking normal, natural, healthy risks, whether it's physical risks like running too fast on concrete, or whether it's social risks like asking a friend to play and possibly being rejected. So some of this is emotional social risk and some of it's physical risk.
So do you really think that parents today are sort of inhibiting the risk-taking of kids, and that kids are being, I guess, a little coddled and not allowed to try things?
Yeah, it's been called helicopter parenting, but I think it goes deeper than a lot of people think. There's kids that aren't allowed to play outside in their front yards or backyards alone. There's parents who are, when they read Charlotte's Web, they change the ending so the spider doesn't die anymore at the end. That's an emotional risk that the child's being protected from. So I think we're scared of those tough emotions, and I think we're living in a bit of a culture of fear as far as, you know, strangers and what strangers might do to our family.
Right. I mean, as parents, you know, we're excruciatingly aware that bad stuff happens to kids. We see news stories about kids falling off stuff and getting hurt, kids getting abducted. So how do we make room for risk when, you know, we know what to do for the most part to make our kids safe?
Right. Well, you know, safety always needs to be part of it, but we need to be smart about what we're being safe about. So, for example, with don't talk to strangers. We all grew up with that. We all tell our kids that. But it doesn't work. And the main reason it doesn't work is because strangers are not the main danger. It's very, very rare that a stranger would harm a child. Strangers are usually the helpers. They're the person that helps a lost, scared child. Could be a police officer, could be a parent walking down the street. Whereas, unfortunately, and we know that, child abuse and neglect is in the news, and it's a big problem, but it's mostly family, friends, and acquaintances that are the ones that are most likely to harm the child. So we need to change the advice and our own actions that are to keep the kids safe.
And you really mean this. I was looking at your chapter, and you actually have a list there about how to encourage kids, foster them to take risks. And it begins with, well, here's how to let your kids learn how to handle knives, and here's hammers and saws. So you really mean this.
I really mean it. I grew up going to a preschool in Columbus, Ohio, that for the four-year-olds, they had sharp saws and hammers in the woodworking area, and you could go there any time and work with them. Now, giving kids a little bit of guidance is good, but this is not just one unusual preschool. For example, many people are comfortable with the Montessori program, or at least they've heard of it. Well, they give, in Montessori, it's very typical to have practical life skills, where they give sharp knives to kids and they train them how to cut up fruits and vegetables for snacks. So it's not a way out there idea, but I think we're getting more and more nervous and even letting a 9-year-old use a knife, you know, whereas a 3- and 4-year-old with proper training can do all sorts of things.
What do you think are the long-term, I guess, risks for our kids if we don't let them learn about some of the ways we can take risks and grow?
Yeah, well, what people are discovering is that when kids are exposed to healthy risks and get practice judging danger, they actually get more safe, partly because they're taking responsibility for their own safety into their hands instead of expecting that adults around them will just magically keep everything safe for them. But also it takes practice and experience to judge danger. So children don't like getting hurt. They don't like the blood and Band-Aids. And so if they have some tools to avoid actually getting hurt, they're more likely to do that. The long-term risks for kids who aren't exposed to enough risk, they're afraid to make mistakes. They become more risk-averse. And you can think of all the implications for that, including entrepreneurship and artistic and creative risk. There's all sorts of levels of risk that kids need to continually be able to take.
We're talking with Heather Shoemaker right now. She's a parenting and early childhood expert and the author of the new book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. And another aspect you get at in the book is letting kids be in control of their own bodies. And in a nutshell, this is sort of, you know, letting them be in charge of saying no if they don't want, say, to hug their great-grandma when she comes for a visit. But don't we want to raise kids to be polite and respectful?
Yes. Well, you put your finger on it because we get these two. There's two competing interests here, and we get them mixed up. One is about teaching basic manners and modeling politeness and helping kids learn what normal greetings are and how to do that themselves. And the other is about being safe and being, quite frankly, respectful no matter what age you are. So for us to be respectful of a young child might, if that child does not want a big, juicy kiss from grandma right now, you know, sometimes the grandparents come at the little ones with just so much devotion, it's hard for the little one to fend them off. But a lot of kids, especially at first, don't want that touch, and they don't know how to say no. So we need to respect that and say, you know, Josh doesn't want any kisses right now. He doesn't want to be hugged, but he's good with handshakes. You know, give them an option. Kids normally warm up, but it's part of basic safety again. A child needs to learn that they can set a limit on another person's actions. I don't like it when you kiss me with those juicy kisses to grandma. You know, I just want to be kissed on my elbow. Whatever it is that the child can set a limit, because it gets back into the stranger danger we were just talking about. You know, most of the harm actually does come from these friends and family that we know so well. So kids need to learn, in order to stay safe, that they need to be able to set limits on other people, including if they're grandparents or uncles or aunts.
And you also say that recess should be a right along the way. In your book, you talk about the rights of children, and recess is one of them. Now, most kids kind of start out with a lot of recess, a fair amount of outdoor play that's unstructured. It kind of tapers as they go along, but why do you think that recess should be a right?
Yes, well, I'm focusing particularly on the elementary school kids, because as you say, recess tends to taper off. But unfortunately, across the country, a lot of places, children as young as first grade and kindergarten are not getting recess. In some places, it's been eliminated. In places where recess is still going strong, it's actually there's fewer of them throughout the day. You know, I grew up, I had three recesses as a kid, morning recess, lunch recess, afternoon recess. Now, a school that has a good amount of recess might have two. A lot of them have one. And so there's fewer breaks in the day. They tend to be shorter. And another thing that's happening is they tend to be more organized. So, for example, since a lot of schools are trying to fit in curriculum, they will say, okay, well, we'll have recess on two of the days and gym class on the other days.
We're talking right now with Heather Shoemaker. She's the author of It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. And she's telling us about why some time-honored parenting rules, things that we grew up hearing from our parents, might need a rewrite these days.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are we too risk-averse with our kids? Are we overprotecting them, not letting them take risks and grow while they're doing it? Do you think it's time to rethink these time-honored rules of parenting, these ideas like safety first, mandatory participation in group activities, enforcing the value of homework? Do we need to rethink all of that? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Heather Shoemaker. She's the author of It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. And she's telling us why breaking some time-honored parenting rules can be a good thing if you want to raise confident kids.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do we spend too much time shielding kids from risk? Let your kids, teach your kids how to use, you know, the regular old-fashioned pointy silverware, the tools you have in your garage, or is that something you want to hold off on? Safety first. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Heather, before we get to our callers, I do want to get into homework here. You recently wrote a piece for Salon looking at homework. You think it should be banned, that there's not any real reason to have elementary school kids doing homework. What's the case for that?
Yes, well, what they're finding with research is that the academic benefits of homework are highly age-dependent. So if you're at the high school level, there's some good that can come of it if it's not too many hours a day. You know, sort of after 2 hours, it tapers off. In middle school, there's a little bit of benefit. But at the elementary level, what they've discovered in the research is that the time spent on homework has no correlation at all to academic achievement in elementary school. And this is not just one study. It's a meta-analysis of 180 research studies done on homework, found no correlation in elementary school.
It's hard to shake loose the idea, though, that, you know, you have to learn how to do this. And maybe it's not even just completing the homework. Maybe it's learning how to focus and sit down and have deep sort of attention paid to one thing, and that is what homework teaches kids to do. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, what you just mentioned, deep focus and attention and all those things, you know, kids are asked to do that a lot during the school day. They're asked to sit still. They're asked to focus on what they're being taught. And so at the end of the school day, it's a question of how should those hours at the end of the school day be spent. And for young children, we're talking about kindergarten, five-year-olds up through the end of elementary school. These kids are still very young, and they have so many needs that are non-academic. You know, physical motion, a break from just being told what to do so they can follow their own ideas. That's called play. Family chores and responsibilities, learning how to be part of a family. Being outside, having bedtime stories, going to bed early. There's so many things that young kids need to do, and we need to value those things. And they've already had a heavy dose of the sitting still and focusing in the school day.
And you actually, you make good on this. It sounds as though you write letters to your kids' elementary school teachers and say, we don't allow homework in this family. How does that work?
Yes. Well, as a child myself, I went to an elementary school that did not give homework. So I went to a highly academic high school. So I know that it can work, that if you meet the needs of the kids today, they don't have to practice getting ready for high school when they're 5 and 6 and 7. They need to have their needs met today. So when I became a parent and I sent my first child off to elementary school, I was quite confident that he had better ways to spend his time in the off-school hours. So I just approached the teachers, and I explained what we valued as a family and how he needed to have his learning supported at home, and how we were going to support what she did in the classroom by getting him to bed early. Because, you know, that's funny. That's where the research really backs up. If you want improved test scores and memory and focus and learning and problem-solving skills and better behavior, it's more sleep for these young kids, not homework.
Well, we're talking with Heather Shoemaker right now. She's the author of It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Kurt on the line in Oconomowoc. Kurt, hi.
Hi there. I have an older stepson. He's 14. And my question is, he tends to not look up when my folks or my wife's folks come into the door to have dinner or whatnot. He's stuck on his computer, and that whole business about the respect for family and whatnot struck a chord with me, and I was wondering if you have any advice for older children, not just the younger ones who are more malleable, if you will.
Malleable is a great adjective there. Your question brings up a lot of things. One is we're trying to instill basic respect and expectations with greetings. So at a certain age, and usually it's around mid-elementary school, you can expect that a child will begin to greet people in a way that we'd expect. And if you have an older child who isn't, or any age that isn't, once they've crossed that threshold of they should developmentally be able to, it's time to mention it, that this is bothering you and this is what you expect when someone comes to the door. But you mentioned screens, and I have a section in the book about technology. We need to be able to teach kids and model appropriate behavior for screen use. So if there's a real person that enters the room, that real person deserves attention. And if that's important to us, we need to start setting those expectations for whatever age children we have.
And as you said, modeling those things ourselves, you have a big section on screen use in your book, and it sounds as though you also think that a lot of kids, research shows, are worried about their parents not being able to control themselves around screens.
Yes, well, you know, our generation, we didn't grow up with this ourselves, and now we're trying to parent kids with all these screens. It's almost like the adults are kids in a candy shop. We just can't stop eating the screens. So as we have young kids in our lives, the kids are not seeing any boundaries on adult use of screens, and so they think that it's okay to interrupt people at all times or to be oblivious to people of all times, the way our caller just mentioned. They are following what we are doing, and we need to be more conscious of our adult use of our phones and our other screens, because it's just like modeling nutrition. You know, we don't have chocolate fudge and potato chips for dinner every night. We try to serve a balanced meal, because what we do is what the kids notice.
Well, thank you for the call, Kurt. And we're going to go next to Matt in Middleton. Matt, hi.
Hello. I'm wondering if you've done any meta-analysis on family size and the correlation between picking up skills at a younger age and also where we live, whether you're in the city or out in a rural area. If I could just give one observation that I've had, mm-hmm. is as my wife and I have had more kids, we have 9 now, and we've noticed that the last 3 or 4 pick up skills that we wouldn't assume that they have had at a very young age. And we noticed that the 2.5 to 3-year-old, if they're hungry, they don't come and ask us anymore. They'll go and take out a waffle out of the freezer, and they'll go put it in the toaster, toast it, butter it. And you come out, it's like, oh, who did that for you? It's like, I did.
Wow, so they're more self-sufficient. Matt, thank you for that call. So Matt has 9 kids. He's wondering about family size and also about where you live, country kids or rural kids?
Yeah.
Or city kids?
It's a great point. I think, I did not do the research myself. I'm the messenger collecting the research, because what I think is that the gap that we have between what we know about kids and child development and brain research and how humans develop and what we're doing about kids, that gap is ever widening. So I'm sort of the messenger between the research and the families. So I can't give him any great answer on the meta-analysis. That's not something I've done. But it's certainly observation-wise, people have said that kids pick it up, that modeling does happen. It happens not just with the adults. It happens with the older siblings. So younger kids do tend to be more self-sufficient and pick up things earlier socially if they have a whole bunch of siblings ahead of them.
Okay, I think we have time for one more quick call. Kathy in Madison. Briefly, what did you want to bring up, Kathy?
I just came on halfway through the show, so I don't know if you covered this, but I have a concern about children. I don't like children because they're rude and obnoxious. And when I heard your call or your speaker saying that it's okay for kids to run, they should, you know, be able to fall and take chances and such, I was thinking that's what's so rude about children. The parents let them run into people, into the street, in the parking lots. Good grief.
Well, Kathy, I'm going to jump in. We're getting low on time, but I mean, Heather, maybe Kathy is a skewed sample of one there, but what do you think about raising kids that are good people, that right. other people like?
Well, one thing that parents need to do at all times is set limits and set appropriate limits. So the caller's giving examples of times when children have not had the right limits set on them. And if you're uncertain what's an appropriate limit, is it hurting people or property? So running into somebody, that's hurting someone. It's not being aware of the people around you. Running fast is one thing. So sometimes setting a limit means just changing the location or the timing, such as you can wave that stick around, but not close to people. If you need to wave the stick, do it over here. Yes, you can play outside, but not now. It's nap time. So changing locations and timing, setting limits so that people and property are not hurt.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That was Heather Shoemaker, parenting and early childhood expert and the author of the new book, It's Okay to Go Up the Slide, Renegade Rules for Raising Confident and Creative Kids.
Sitting has been getting a bad rap over the last few years, with research pointing to the negative health effects of just, you know, sitting all the time. So there's been a lot of interest among me about the possibility of getting some kind of, you know, one of them standing workstations.
Yeah, you've been talking about this. You've been making rumblings for the past couple of years. You still haven't made the change.
Like and 8 years, I think, something like that.
Well, for a while. Let's say for a while. And today, NPR did a report on some new research that says it's actually not that clear that there are health benefits from switching to a standing desk or even one of those treadmill desks where you rotate your feet around. Mm-hmm. You know, the evidence may not be there. We've been hearing that sitting is the new smoking. Maybe not.
Maybe not. Well, the sitting is bad, but it sounds like it's not clear. They can't prove that those standing desks are going to fix the problem. You know, just not enough research, maybe. Not enough people trying it. So maybe I should finally get that standing workstation here at work or at home and be a guinea pig and give it a try.
I'm worried about you looming over people who may share an office space with you. Other than that, it might be all right.
You're very loom-averse, I find.
This is true. I don't like the looming.
Yeah, so let's both do it. You don't want to do it.
No.
I don't know. So I want one that you can go up and down with, and so you're not committed to standing all the time. Well, hey, in the end, maybe it's not the standing workstation. We'll take some advice from UW basketball fans and get out of our seats and jump around. This is Central Time. I can't make it down.